Full Service Radio programming is available on our website, fullserviceradio.org, and as a podcast, thanks to Simplecast. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Tuned in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
You're listening to the DC Public Library on Full Service Radio, broadcasting live from the Lion Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. I am your co-host today, Olubunmi Bakari, and I'm joined by...
Hi, everyone. My name's Victor Benitez.
In today's DCPL Presents series, we're joined by Reverend Dr. Sandra Butler Truesdale. Reverend Truesdale is a native Washingtonian. Her family has been here for generations. She is DC. And also a rhythm and blues historian. She is the chairperson for the DC Legendary Musicians and is the co-host of Don't Forget the Blues on WPFW FM 89.3 every Wednesday at noon. Welcome, Dr. Truesdale.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
And what should we call you? Should we call you Dr. Truesdale?
No, you should call me Sandra.
Okay, Sandra. Okay.
Well, welcome, Sandra. I'm very happy to sit here with you again. I think this is the third time we've met in person. So thanks for joining us today.
Well, again, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Okay, so... You're a native Washingtonian, so tell us a little bit about your family's history. When did they come to D.C., and, you know, what was it like for you growing up here?
Well, actually, I love to say this. I'm a fourth-generation Washingtonian. Okay. My family has been here since 1813.
Okay. 1813, that's a long time.
That's a long time.
More than most people in this city.
Yeah.
I'm sure.
My great-great-great aunt, her name was Emma Dove, purchased two properties on Cochran Street Northwest, mm-hmm. 1458 and 1460. And we were... raised in that home. We still own the home, mm-hmm. One of the houses at least, 1458. Mm-hmm. And that was our neighborhood.
Sandra, is that the Shaw neighborhood?
That is what they now call the Shaw neighborhood. But early on, that was a part of DuPont Circle.
Okay.
Uh-huh. It was, and actually they call that Central City, okay. because it is a Zone 1 property.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah.
Do you know when they started calling it Shaw or why they started calling it Shaw?
Well, I don't know why, but what I do remember about that is that when the old Dunbar Hotel was at 15th and U Streets Northwest, when they it deteriorated under a certain management, and what they did was to begin, that's when gentrification really began. And that's been somewhere over 40 years ago when that first started. So when the hotel deteriorated, they tore that down. Now, you know, that's one block from what was known as St. Paul, which mm-hmm. is now known as St. Augustine. Mm-hmm. And that was St. Paul and Augustine at one point.
Mm-hmm. Catholic Church?
The Catholic Church.
Okay.
Right on the corner. So the Dunbar Hotel was like across the street from there. However, they tore that down, and it became the Campbell Heights Apartments.
Okay.
And then I had the opportunity to work with that residence council there, and we purchased that building, mm-hmm. and is now known again as the Paul Lawrence Dunbar Apartments.
Okay.
But the answer to your question, I went into a whole nother thing. the answer to your question was when they tore down the Dunbar Hotel, Walter Fauntroy and some others extended that to be the Shaw area. Mm-hmm. Now remember, 15th and U and 15th and Cochran are only like about four blocks right. from each other. So that's when I remember that it became the Shaw area.
Okay.
And so, you know, you grew up in Washington. What were some of the schools that you attended?
The elementary school that I went to was Garrison, mm-hmm. and Garrison at that time was on 12th and Vermont Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
They since moved it to R Street, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But I attended Garrison, And then I attended what was known as Shaw Junior High. Mm-hmm. Shaw Junior High was on the corner of 7th and Rhode Island Avenue, which is diagonally across from Walter T. Daniels Library. After when I graduated from Shaw, I then attended and graduated from Cardozo Senior High. Mm-hmm. And then on to, of course, to HU, you know.
And so the Shaws... Before Shaw was Shaw Junior High School, that was the old McKinley Tech.
No. That was before Shaw Junior High School was Shaw Junior High School. It actually was an all-boys academy there. Okay. Right now, the name of it escapes me.
It's the Asbury Dwellings.
No, it's now the Asbury Dwellings. Yeah. The Asbury Dwellings came after they moved Shaw Junior High School over to Rhode Island Avenue.
Right.
And that's when Asbury, I think that's Asbury, that's a senior citizens building now, yes.
And that's the building that's diagonally across from the Shaw Library.
Exactly.
Where we work. Very cool. In thinking back about Garrison and the Shaw Junior High, what memories stand out for you? What were those buildings like? What were the teachers like? What were the other students like?
Well, you know, it was a neighborhood elementary school. And so, of course, we all knew each other. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I always tell people is with Washington, D.C. having only four quadrants, it was not a big city, and it's still not a big city. It's a small town. And everybody knew each other. Mm-hmm. We knew each other by family names, basically. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes I smile and laugh, and I tell young people, you know, you couldn't go to one other part of the city and do your little dirt without your parents before you got home. They already knew that you were someplace maybe you shouldn't have been. Mm-hmm. But it was almost like big family. Mm-hmm. You know, all the whole community knew each other. Everybody knew each other's children. There was a great music in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. There are great musicians who come from here other than Duke Ellington and my good friend Marvin Gaye. Mm-hmm. There are many great musicians who come out of Washington. Almost every home, I will say almost every home, had a musical instrument of some kind in it. We were fortunate because we had a piano and an organ, and my grandfather played the harmonica. My grandmother sang. Mm-hmm. So it was always music in our neighborhoods. And it's one of those things where things weren't like they are now. Mm-hmm. So when we went to school, one of the older children took us to school. Your parents didn't have to really just, you know, literally take you to school. Mm-hmm. So there's always one or two young people who may have been 12 and you were 6. And they made sure that you got to school all right. And then at the end of school, the teachers knew all of this. And the teachers would get all these children who were going in the same direction together for whoever was responsible for taking them home. Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm saying it was a neighborhood, a real village, a real community. And you know what? I can name my teachers from kindergarten.
Oh, wow.
All the way up to 8th grade, and then even teachers from Cardozo. Mm-hmm. I can tell you their names, and I can almost visualize the school, because our schools were smaller, and every teacher almost knew. They knew almost every child in the school.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. Were there any like prominent teachers that you had? Because I know in some instances, because of segregation, that teachers or black teachers that had PhDs had to teach at lower levels at certain periods. And I've heard that some teachers, like at Shaw in particular, they had some teachers that went on to go to like Howard, and they later became well known.
Well, I know that the principal at Cardozo, when I was there, his name was Mr. Saunders. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Saunders was a great educator. Mm-hmm. And you're right, when Mr. Saunders left Cardozo, he did go to Howard University as a professor. Mm-hmm. And you're right, many of them probably should have been in higher education, but they chose to, or they could, because there was it was limited. Mm-hmm. They taught in the high schools, or maybe even junior high school, but it benefited us as students because we got an education mm-hmm. in Washington, D.C. that many people farther south did not. Mm-hmm. Some people get really angry with me when I tell them that my high school education literally was equivalent to what they got as a college mm-hmm. graduate. Mm-hmm. I was able, even before I graduated from college, mm-hmm. I was able to articulate and communicate mm-hmm. with people who had come here from further south and said that they had graduated from college. I was able to communicate on their level even then. Mm-hmm. So in Washington, D.C., I can't really speak for other cities, but there was a great respect mm-hmm. for education. Now, you all need to remember that when I came along in our block, the professionals, everybody lived in the same block. We had a dentist, mm-hmm. we had a college professor, mm-hmm. we had a high school teacher. All of them lived in the 1400 block of Corcoran Street. Mm-hmm. So we actually literally had something to aspire to. Mm-hmm.
That's great.
Yeah, we actually talked about that a little bit in the car. I'm coming here. But it was a different topic. We won't talk about what we were talking about.
Sandra, I wanted to ask you about your time at Howard University. What was it like to attend Howard University? And what did you study while you were there?
I studied child development and welfare. Okay. My father graduated from Howard University. Mm-hmm. So that was a great achievement for me. To go to the same college that my father graduated from. Many of my classmates, now remember, Cardozo was a business school. Mm-hmm. But by the time I went to Cardozo, it was what they called unrestricted. You could take academic courses as well as business courses. And I chose to take what they called an unrestricted course. Mm-hmm. So when I graduated, I could go to college or I could go to work. Mm-hmm. I met a lot of wonderful people. There was a gentleman there that I hate to tell y'all this. I was just in love with him. I just thought he was just so fabulous. His name was Harold Vick. And Harold Vick was a saxophonist. Mm-hmm. And he was a jazz saxophonist. Mm-hmm. And he played, not only was he a student at Howard, but he also played in the Howard Theater Band. Mm-hmm. And I just thought he was, you know.
Hot stuff.
Yeah, well, he was too. But it was not just that. That was another place where there was a community and a great relationship. I remember that I really wanted to stay on campus. But my first year, I started to stay on campus, and being, I guess, an only child and kind of spoiled, you know, I could see that there were some differences in the lifestyles that I was used to. Mm-hmm. And so I decided to stay home. Mm. And
you want to tell us a little bit about that?
No. Because things are very different now. Right. People felt very differently about. And we say, from my generation, from back there, we say lifestyles. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, as I have learned, even from my neighborhood on Corcoran Street, and even as I have educated myself and been friends with people who are of different, what is it that I want to say? Well, let me just get it out there. Many of my friends, and I hate saying it like this, many of my friends are gay. But when I came along at Howard University back then as a young woman, people would tell you all kinds of different things about the gay community and what might happen. You as a female and she's a lesbian and this is going to happen, you know. And so I was fearful mm-hmm. early on until I learned better. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the reasons that I stayed home. But it was an interesting situation with me because in my neighborhood, there were several gays in my neighborhood. And nobody thought anything about it. They were just, hey, that was just another person.
Just a part of the community.
It was just part of the community, and that's what it was. But and when I went to high school, almost the young men in particular, because the women did not come out as early, but the young, a lot of the young males, you could, the people called them, they would say they're effeminate. They always took to me for some reason. I don't know why, but I think what I do think about that is that they knew that I didn't treat them any different than I treated anybody else. They was my buddies, and we hung, okay?
You have a warm...
Well, yeah, but, you know, we was just doing what we do. Yeah. But I decided to stay home and go to school, and there were many reasons for that.
It was cheaper, too.
It was cheaper. It was cheap because all I had to do is get on the bus from Petworth and ride down to Howard University. So that's all it was. Yeah. And with a school ticket. Y'all don't know about school tickets, okay?
Well, this is a school ticket.
It's like the tokens, right?
It's similar, but it was a paper ticket that came in a book of tickets. Mm-hmm. And in this book of tickets, you would go to the car barn, and it was a car barn on Georgia Avenue and V, and one on 14th and Colorado. So you would go there with this document that they would give you at school, and you would pay for this book of school tickets, a little pink thing, and you would pull it off and drop it in the box, you know. And so your fare was less than the adults' fare.
Yeah, we had something like that, similar, coming up. Ticket. Now, we had a chance to talk to you prior to this interview. And, you know, we're at the D.C. Public Library. And you shared with us a story about your first, I don't want to call it interaction, but your first experience visiting D.C. Public Library. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
And actually, you know, it was the Mount Pleasant Library. Okay. Which was right here at, I think that's 16th Street.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And we were kids. There was a young lady in our neighborhood named Jessie Alexander, and she loved to go to the library. She was always with books and whatnot. So she took us to the library. We didn't know any better, so we walked up 15th Street, you know, walked past Meridian Hill Park, that they now call Malcolm X Park, walked on past there, and walked up into the library. And much to our surprise, they said we couldn't come in the library. We didn't know why we couldn't come in. We didn't know. We were young.
So what library did Jessie frequent?
She apparently went to the library on K Street.
Okay, downtown.
We called it the K Street Library.
Okay.
And blacks could come in that library and get books, apparently. But for some reason, she decided, and I guess because we were so young, she was trying to take us to the closest library. And when we got up there, when we left, we still didn't know that we weren't allowed in the library because we were black.
Mm. When did you find out that was the reason? Or how did you find out?
I think that, and if I remember correctly, I think that when I went to school and was explaining this to my teacher, her name was Leona Dotson, and I was explaining to her, you know, we went to the library and you know, I've always been a feisty little thing. And you all are always telling us to read. And then they wouldn't let us come in. And she set us down, me down, and explained to me that blacks could not go in that library. And she explained to me that I should go to the K Street Library.
Now, how old were you at this time?
I might have been 9 or 10. But I was very young. And the other thing about that is back at that time, our parents didn't talk to us about segregation. All we knew was we all lived in a neighborhood where everybody was black except Mr. Wolf, who owned the grocery store across the street. And we didn't know about white people. We just knew that we were in our own community doing... Only time I ever saw white people was if I got on a streetcar, and all the streetcar drivers were white. But I don't think I paid much attention to, that he looked different from me. It wasn't something that was really on my mind, you know?
Well, let's change gears a little bit and talk about music. I guess, when did you realize that the music scene in D.C. was so unique and special?
Here's a little story. When I was real young, of course, I told you it was music everywhere. Mm-hmm. They used to have what they called street bands. Mm-hmm. And they, interestingly enough, played washboards. They played tin tubs. Mm-hmm. And they used to play a tin tub, like a wash tub, and it would be a string or a cord in there tied to a broom. And they would play that, and it would sound just like an upright bass. Mm. And so they played the washboard and the tin tub, and they also, some fortunate young people might have a horn that their parents might have got from the pawn shop or something, and they would have, you know, play the horn. And you would hear music on almost every corner. So I learned to love music early. And the other thing is that with my grandfather played the harmonica, and I told you my grandmother sang, and we had an organ and a piano. So I learned to appreciate Bach and Brahms and all that as a child, because that's what we listened to. We listened to the radio. My grandfather was a great march man. He loved marches. And so we had to listen to that music. Later on, my uncles loved jazz. Mm-hmm. And so they were listening to Charlie Parker and Miles Davis and John Coltrane. So I learned to appreciate that music. Then when I became a teenager, I'm just like these teenagers now. We rejected the jazz and decided to listen to R&B. Because the R&B was coming, the Clovers and the Spaniels and all these groups were coming. Mm-hmm. So we began to listen to what is known as R&B.
Mm. Interesting. So, and of course, Howard Theater was like one of the venues that hosted a lot of black artists. Did you frequent those places?
Did I? Girl, yes. the Howard Theater. My mother took me to the Howard Theater when I was a little girl. The first person I ever saw at the Howard Theater was Lena Horne.
Oh, really?
And Lena Horne was not a singer then. She was a dancer. She was on the chorus line. And so I remember that she was so pretty. And she was tall and had these long legs. And she was, you know, dancing. I can look now. And if I close my eyes, I can see me sitting in that theater watching her play. And then there was another group who was called Louis Jordan and the Jordan Five. Mm. And they played, that was the beginning of R&B.
Wasn't he in a movie?
He was.
What's the movie?
I can't tell you. That's
was it with
that's way
Dorothy
back
Dandridge? No.
It might
have. It was some movie.
I can't remember.
Okay, yeah, I can't. I'm going to look it up, but go ahead.
But yes, Louis Jordan and the 1045, and then, of course, Count Basie and Duke Ellington. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was the big band sound. And so I learned, the greatest thing in my whole life is that I learned to appreciate all genres of music. I learned to not just, I learned to appreciate classical music. It just engulfed me. And so when I came to junior high school, there was a gentleman here called Don Covey. And Don Covey and Marvin Gaye and Chester and some other people, they formed a group, Reese Palmer. And so they were singing. And
so you knew Marvin Gaye before he became famous?
Marvin and I took music together.
Oh.
We took music from Mr. Finley at Cardozo Senior High School.
Oh, yeah, he did go to Cardozo, didn't he?
Mm-hmm.
What was he like?
He was a nice young man. I could always tell. You know, there's some people that you know they're different. Mm-hmm. You know that they know
they
where they're going.
It. Yeah.
You just already know. The first time I ever heard him, Marvin was a boy soprano. Mm-hmm. And the first time I ever heard him was I was in the hall at Cardozo Senior High School. And Mr. Finley was rehearsing them. And I heard this beautiful soprano voice. And I was like, where is that coming from? So I went in the auditorium, and it was Marvin. Mm-hmm. He was, singing. And he was a really focused. He was already focused on his music. And I think we were like 14, 15 years old. He and another guy, called, his name was Reese Palmer. Mm-hmm. And they ended up singing with a group called the Moonglows, mm-hmm. with Harvey Fuqua. Mm-hmm. Out of, I think Harvey came out of Chicago or Detroit. But that was an interesting, because after he left Cardoza, he didn't graduate, you see. Mm-hmm. He left Cardoza and went into the service. Mm-hmm. And after that, the rest of it is history.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Sandra, you obviously rubbed shoulders with musicians. You've seen so many performances here in D.C. But now you work and represent musicians with your work in the D.C. Legendary Musicians. How did that came about?
And what are the DC, what is the D.C. Legendary Musicians?
Okay, let me start out by telling you I worked for James Brown and Ray Charles.
James Brown.
I worked for him for 2 years. And at that time, he was James Brown and the Famous Flames. Mm. Bobby Bennett, Bobby Bird, and Lloyd Stallworth. Those were the backup singers. Mm. And I worked for him as, I was a cosmetologist too, okay. My trade.
So you did his hair?
I did his hair.
That's awesome.
And was that a press and curl?
No. He wore a process.
Oh, okay.
Which is a whole different set of
chemicals
of,
and,
yeah, yeah, chemicals and mm-hmm. whatever. And his hair was done by a guy named Square John. Mm-hmm. And what I did was I did the upkeep.
You did the curls and everything?
I did the comb out.
Oh, the comb out.
See, that's
out. Okay.
That's different.
Okay.
See, because the process was waves. They mm-hmm. had their hair in these real deep waves. Mm-hmm. And what I would do is in between sets or in between him going to get his hair done. Now, remember, we wanted to have hair like some other people.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And so we put all that chemical in our hair. And like I said, it was a process. You know, you got it set in waves. And girl, that was actually, do you know that was a lie? Ooh. That they put in that hair mm-hmm. to straighten it?
Yeah.
And then they would, sometimes they would sit under this lie to straighten it so long till their scalp would be burning. Mm-hmm. Then they got to have water poured on it. And then they set the wave mm-hmm. and they go under the dryer. Mm-hmm. And so, like I said, then, but what I did is I did the upkeep
okay.
on his hair.
Okay.
Now, with Ray Charles, I did the Raylettes hair.
Okay.
There was Marianne, and there was a whole group, Margie Hendrix, and
yeah.
that whole group.
Marianne.
Mm.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So, the movie with Ray, was that how you remembered it? Like?
Almost exactly.
Mm-hmm.
It was, that was interesting.
So Margie, like, they never said what happened to her?
Margie, she did finally, she passed away.
Mm.
But Margie and Marianne both were in love with Ray.
Mm.
And that was an interesting kind of,
what now, he that? Supposedly had a child with Margie. In the
he
movie.
Had a child with, I think he had a child with Marianne. It was very, it was, I think it was devastating to the both of them,
mm-hmm.
you know, because and Ray was married.
Right, right.
And so, yes, he was having fun. But,
sorry. He was having fun.
But.
No, give us the juice.
No, Ray was another different, he was a genius
mm-hmm.
As far as music is concerned.
Right.
And he was, but he was a, in my opinion, he was a kind soul.
Mm-hmm.
He was very different from James.
Mm-hmm.
James was sort of kind of sadistical.
Mm-hmm.
He had some other issues mm-hmm. that had to do with not just women, but his relationships with the people in his band and how he treated them.
Mm-hmm. They had a film about him. Was that accurate?
It was close to it. I've always wondered, that's one of the reasons that I didn't stay with him very long, was because of the way that he, basically the way that he treated women, because he was very, very, very abusive. You see, there was three verys right there, very abusive to women.
How did you first get connected with them?
With or, James?
Yeah, or how did you get these gigs?
There was a gentleman who lived at my house, his name was Clayton Filliott. And Clayton was from New Orleans, but Clayton was James's drummer.
Mm-hmm.
And he, I met him while I was working. Actually, I went to school, to a school called Poro Beauty School. And Poro was one half block from the Howard Theater.
Okay.
So I met a lot of entertainers, but I met Clayton there, and he was looking for a place to stay. Mm-hmm. And we lived in a very large house, so we rented him our attic. And at this time, he said, okay, I want you to meet James and whatnot. But I actually really got involved in working for James because Square John was a friend of mine, because his barbershop was one block from Poro Beauty School.
Mm-hmm.
And James was looking for, he wanted Square to travel with him. And Square says, no, I got somebody who can go and they can do it, and she's good at what she does or whatever. And so he was the one that recommended me to work with James Brown. And I asked my mom, and she said, you know, it was okay for me to go. And so that's how I really connected with him. But remember now, as kids, the Howard Theater was there. And even at when I was going to Cardozo, every Thursday we would go to the Howard Theater.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was the last show.
Oh, the last show.
The shows at the Howard Theater started on Saturdays. And it would go from Saturday to Thursday. And Thursday was the last night. And also, you could go in the Howard Theater and pay 90 cents before 5 o'clock. And you could stay in the theater. You could go in at 1 o'clock and stay in the theater till 10 o'clock. And the other thing was they had 5 and 6 acts on the show. And these were really well-known acts that you could stay in and watch that show.
Mm-hmm.
And so we, you know, after school, we would go. Or sometimes even before after school, we would go to the Howard Theater and sit and watch the shows because it was so much fun. You could dance in the aisles at that time. You know, wasn't any, you know. And see, violence was tempered. It wasn't like it is now.
Yeah. Well, you were on a panel at the Shaw Library about the role that some of the musicians from Howard Theater had after the 1968 riots or uprising. Can you talk to us briefly about that?
You're saying that when you say the role that they had.
Right, in the community, in the lead up to the riots and then after, in kind of establishing order or building community once again.
Well, let me tell you that the destruction of the Howard Theater began even a little bit before the riots. You know, it began to deteriorate. But the riots are what really caused the real destruction, the last real closing of the theater. And the theater was empty for almost, I don't want to give some wrong information, but I'm thinking 10 or 15 years that that theater was closed. They did try to reopen it one time, and it did not work. And then we went in, the Howard Theater Community Committee that I chaired went in with the Ellis Brothers, who were the developers there, and we worked with them to bring the reopening or the rebirth of the Howard Theater. So now you need to remember that they're great musicians and groups, the Clovers, who did One Mint Julep and several other songs. They were from here. And a lot, Greg Gaskins, who played 14 years with the Manhattans and then played also with Elvis Presley, is from here and still lives here. Skip Pitts, that played with Isaac Hayes, played guitar. He played the riffs on John Shaft. So all these people are native Washingtonians who live here. And there's several more. I just, like I said, Don Covey, even though he came out of North Carolina.
What, you mean that famous opening from Shaft? That's a
Yeah, that's Charles Skip Pitts.
Oh,
came off of Euclid Street.
Okay.
Right there at the 1400 block of U Street. 1400 block of Euclid.
Okay.
So all of these people are native Washingtonians. They performed here. First of all, and then there's Jimmy Smooth, who is from here and gave so many of the musicians work. He's still local and plays all over the East Coast and plays here. He'll be playing at the Yards. And incidentally, I'll be going to Denmark in August. They are going to have an Elvis Presley reunion, and so I'm going to accompany Stump Monroe, who was Elvis's drummer, and Greg Gaskins, who was the guitarist, on that event. But yes.
Oh, that's awesome.
We have, I mean, it's just, you all, if you do the research, you know, which I'm doing now, you will find it's just amazing. The musicians who came from here, and as well the musicians who once they got here or they played here, they love this town so much they decided to stay here, because Washington, D.C. was a real village and a real community. We always loved the arts and we always loved the music. Something has happened within the gentrification that has caused it to deteriorate, but we are fighting real hard, real hard. One of the other blessings is that the DC Public Libraries has allowed me and others to do so many events that have to do with this great music. I'm pleased and I'm proud. We just did one with Maggie Gilmore. You all know that. Oh, at the Anacostia Library. Yeah, we turned it out too.
Okay.
At the Sultan, right?
Yes.
Yeah, Anacostia. Yeah.
It was wonderful.
Right. And I think it was performing songs from like 50 years ago.
Yes. And all the way up to now.
All the way up to now.
Uh-huh.
That's great.
And it was fantastic.
Yeah. Well, we've been kind of talking here and there about the DC legendary musicians that you founded. When did you form this group?
I formed the group in 2002.
Okay.
And we actually, as I explained to you all before, we're a service organization.
Okay.
What we do is to help musicians who may or they may need a hand up now. Some of our musicians, like Woody Woodson, who now has, he had diabetes and had a leg removed. He was a great drummer. He played for Marvin Gaye, Wilson Pickett, Otis Redding, and some others. And now he has one leg. And so, you know, it's just one of those situations where he needs help. Sometimes our musicians may not have insurance. They pass away. We help to raise money so they can be buried. We help them to get other kinds of services like SSI, Social Security, Medicaid. We work with GW to do that. Mm.
And recently, the D.C. Legendary Musicians received a Humanities D.C. Grant Award for Washington, D.C., jazz, the music, and the metropolis, and beyond. So congratulations on that. And what do you plan on doing with this grant?
Okay. We have already started. There's going to be a book,
okay,
the book that you just mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
We are working with the D.C. Public Libraries and the Washington, D.C. school system to introduce them to the book. We already have an education guide out. We are sharing that guide with the D.C. Public Libraries. We will be going on different settings to talk about and educate people about this great music and the musicians from Washington, D.C.
Mm.
So education, we will be educating people on the music and the arts of the music in Washington, D.C. with this grant. And thank God for D.C. Humanities. They gave us a generous grant of $10,000. And we are able to compensate our musicians and, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and that's definitely awesome. You know, I grew up attending D.C. public schools, and music played a huge role in my life. Played several instruments.
What?
I played the viola, violin, the clarinet. I stuck with the clarinet the longest. Oh, yeah, and the cello also. I was really good at the cello, but I stuck with the clarinet the longest. Yeah, just a little bit, you know.
That's beautiful. I'm glad you told me that, because now you're in trouble.
Uh-oh.
I never knew you about this. About me.
Yes, I am a jack of all trades. Yes, I did. I played. My mother used to call me Bunny Goodman, you know, after Benny Goodman.
Uh-huh.
I can't believe I just said that, but yeah. But yeah, I played the clarinet. So I personally remember playing in the band, like DC
Youth Orchestra.
I played DC Youth Orchestra in the summer, one summer. That was with the clarinet, but I just remember how popular it was when I was in elementary school, middle school.
the Safety Patrol Parade that we played in every year. Mm-hmm. And music was such a huge, you know, part, you know, something that I loved and I still love to this day. I love live music. I love jazz, you know. So, right. Yeah.
Well, see, the greatest thing is, and unfortunately, they are not funding the arts the way that I think that they should. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I fought for when I served on the D.C. Board of Education mm-hmm. was the arts. I had the blessing to serve 8 years as the Ward 4 representative to the Board of Education. And that was one of the things that I tried to make sure while it was in my tenure, you know, that those programs were funded, especially the D.C. Youth Orchestra. They have young musicians like Cochran Holt. Cochran Holt is an upright bassist. I just talked to him the other day. This brother's in Brazil. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? He moved from D.C. because he could not
find work.
Mm-hmm. And so now he's in New York. And he's all over the world playing. Mm-hmm. Nasser Abadie's son, Kush Abadie, plays drums. And the beautiful thing is, all these young guys, I used to have them at the Lincoln Theater, you know. And Muhammad and I used to do some shows to expose these young people. Mm-hmm. Now, I have one young man now, Jalan, who is a blues guitarist. He's 14. Mm. You can't believe this young man can play the blues like he does.
And a lot of, you know, our homegrown go-go music, a lot of musicians started out playing in school bands here as well.
Junkyard Band. Mm-hmm. I just heard on the station that I am a programmer on some young people doing a rap on Barry Farms mm-hmm. and how they're not going to let it go. And I'm going to be playing that on my show tomorrow. Mm-hmm. But there's still a lot of young musicians who are working forward in mm-hmm. Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. to do the positive thing.
Mm-hmm. And Sandra's show is Don't Forget the Blues. Mm-hmm. And again, it's on WPFW FM 89.3. And that's every Wednesday,
I'm on every Wednesday from 12 until 1. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I guess to wrap up, I guess what's next for the D.C. Legendary Musicians?
Okay. Our next event will be at Capitol Temple Missionary Church in Northeast Washington. We're going to have a gospel concert. It will be with Ida Campbell, Lady Mary, Melvin Caldwell, and some of the other musicians. So we're going to be doing a gospel concert, and then the next one will be our second award ceremony. We'll be doing that in October, and that will take place at Westminster Church.
Bubi, do you have anything else for Sandra?
Well, we can do this little thing I like to do called Fast Five, where I ask you five questions. Uh-oh. Give me the first thing that pops into your head. Okay, what's your favorite book?
Bible.
Oh, somebody finally answered the Bible. Okay. What is your favorite place that you visited anywhere around the world?
Seoul, Korea.
Hmm. Interesting. Favorite musician?
John Coltrane.
Okay. If you could do anything over in your life, is there anything different that you would have done?
No. I mean, you said in one word.
You said
so.
Yeah,
I'm
yes
just saying
no.
I like it like it is.
Okay.
And or maybe one musical performance that you wish you could go back and see that you never got a chance to see.
I would love to have, if I had been really into music at that time, I would love to have seen Charlie Parker in mm-hmm. person.
And the happiest moment in your life?
My daughter was born.
Awesome. Thank you.
Well, Sandra, thank you for joining us today. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you all so much for having me. This has been, it really, you all can see that I can really talk, right? Mm-hmm. I told you about my teacher, Ms. Dotson, who said, Sandra is very smart, but she talks incessantly. Mm-hmm. Well, there you have it.
Thank you.
Okay. This has been an episode of D.C. Public Library Presents on Full Service Radio, broadcasted live from the Lion Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Sandra, thank you for being on today's episode. Please visit us at dclibrary.org to learn more about the library's many resources, programs, and services. Follow us on Instagram at DC Public Library and on Twitter at DCPL. Download this show wherever you listen to your podcast by searching for Full Service Radio / DCPL Radio. Thank you for listening to us and have a good afternoon.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook at Full Service Radio. Thanks for listening.